Well, it's wonderful to be here tonight in this beautiful urban center of Cambridge Insight Meditation Center. We share almost all the letters that you have, CIMC. Our center is Vermont Insight Meditation Center, VIMC, and we're in the woods. So it's quite lovely to be here in Cambridge with all of you tonight. Thank you for coming. I don't know if it was posted downstairs, but the title of tonight's Dharma Talk is Wisdom and Compassion at Work, or The Buddha as a Reflective Practitioner. I don't know how many of you are new to the practice or seasoned practitioners, but I'd like to begin by just giving you a quick slice of the early years of my own practice. In the early days, I really thought it was all about the meditation. Many of you might have that same perspective. I wanted to figure out how to meditate. I wanted to figure out the difference. If I could just figure out the difference between mindfulness and concentration, I knew I would have it all together. I wanted to know what those mental factors felt like inside the body and inside the mind. And that was all during silent meditation practice on the cushion, either at home or on retreat. A story I can tell from the early days of my practice, I think it was about my fourth or fifth retreat. I went on a retreat with Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg and Sylvia Boorstein. And one of the nights of the retreat at Insight Meditation Society, Joseph Goldstein asked for questions. He does this. Some of you who have attended those retreats know how he does this. You put questions on a piece of paper, and then you put them in a bowl, and Joseph reads through them, and he chooses which ones he wants to respond to. And then he comes into the hall, and rather than giving a Dharma talk, as I'm doing tonight, he simply repeats the question from the piece of paper and then expounds the answer. So it was at the end of, in that instance, it was a 14-day retreat, a metta and vipassana retreat. I sat down and very diligently wrote what I thought was an earnest and very fair question. And I put it in the bowl and came into the Dharma hall and, you know, kind of wondered if my question would be picked, right? And some of you may have had this experience. And so about, 10 minutes into the session, Joseph picked up the paper and he started reading what I had written. And I wrote something along these lines. And I was just so, well, proud and excited that he had chosen my question. And he started to read it, and it said something like this: "This retreat has been fantastic, and I'm really committed to enlightenment. And could you please tell me, when I am home alone, what will it look like, and what is it going to feel like when I'm enlightened?" Everybody in the hall, this is a hall of, a large hall of 100 people, everybody burst out laughing. I was mortified. How could they think that was a funny question? I was really, I was earnest in my asking of that question. So 26 years later, I can say quite honestly, and that hence the title of the Dharma Talk tonight, that, the meditation practice, what we did here tonight, those of you who are here for the meditation, what you do when you go on meditation retreats, you're so lucky here at CIMC to have these day-longs with Larry Rosenberg and Narayan and Michael and other renowned teachers that come. I see you're going to have Christopher Germer in October. So all of those experiences are extremely important. They're opportunities for training the mind and actually opening the heart in the practice. But really, and I think that all of the teachers here at CIMC emphasize the same thing, really the place where it actually happens is not on the cushion, but in daily life. Take a moment and just check in with yourself and check in whether there's a lingering perception in your mind that the real stuff happens on the meditation cushion. Is that sitting someplace in the back of your mind? Or maybe, I remember when, particularly on a retreat, you know, you might think that the walking meditation, oh, that's just about standing up and moving your body because you can't sit all day because you'd get cramps. It took a while before I could see that even the walking meditation is an opportunity for waking up right in the moment. So what I'm going to talk about tonight is Dharma in everyday life and the opportunity and the kinds of practices that we can undertake in order to wake up and maybe even become enlightened in the midst of our lives. One of the reasons I gave the title, and Jack and I discussed it, of wisdom and compassion at work is I wanted to make it a little bit ambiguous. So you could say that title means you can practice wisdom and compassion at your job, at work. Or you could say it means certain days, certain times, wisdom and compassion is at work in my heart and my mind as I'm engaged with people, with activities. Or, as it might sound after I'm a little bit ways into the talk, it might sound like getting wisdom and compassion to work is work. So you'll see for yourself. I'm going to tell a few stories of practice, but mostly I'm going to work with three main suttas from the Buddha's teachings. In this way, I find it particularly inspiring to think that the Buddha, who taught 2,600 years ago, is still teaching us today. And in reading and contemplating the suttas, I feel we have a direct connection to this person, who he was, how he taught, and the ways in which we can still apply these to our lives. I wanted to begin with a story, another inspiration for the title of this talk. Jack and I sat with Sayadaw Utejaniya, and some of you may have come to see him. I think he came to Cambridge Insight Meditation Center. He's a Burmese monk, and he was here in, I think it was May, and he taught a two-week retreat at Insight Meditation Society. And it was a wonderful retreat. And what I was particularly moved about Sayadaw Utejaniya was he came at the end of the retreat and he sat up on, the raised, there's a raised altar also at IMS. And he very sincerely sort of sat there. He didn't have his hand on his heart, but it was almost as if he had his hand on his heart. And he looked out at all of us, and he said, please keep doing this practice. Please do it all the time. And I just felt how ardent he was in his in joining us to really take this practice to heart and to not let the retreat experience be this experience that we'd had, and then we'd moved out of it. He said, this is something you can take with you all the time. Later on, after the retreat, he stayed in the hall and answered questions very informally, people talking with him for several hours after the retreat. And I had a burning question at the end of that retreat, and my burning question was, okay, if you want us to do this all the time, how do you do this while watching movies? How do you do this while texting, really thinking about the ordinary kinds of things that we do day in and day out in our lives? And he was unequivocal. He, in his radical belief, said he actually teaches, he didn't do this at the IMS retreat. I don't know, maybe IMS wouldn't have sanctioned it. But he said in Burma, he actually has people bring their iPhones to, you know, sessions like this. And he actually teaches people how to, you know, text, how to do things, and stay awake in the midst of doing all of that. So unfortunately, tonight I'm not going to be doing that with you. But I am going to be talking about how the intentions that we bring to our lives, how these intentions inform our choices, and how our choices then connect with our actions, and how we can begin to see how our intentions, our choices, and our actions can all align themselves to create an inner life that we aspire to, an inner life of peace, greater happiness, greater harmony, and how that inner life can then be translated into what we do every day in our lives. Maybe some of you work in an office, in a classroom, in a hospital, in a law office. Wherever you might work, right there, right then and there, you can engage with the practice and wake up in the midst of your life. Jack and I may not be as ardent as Sayadaw Utejaniya, but we are particularly passionate about daily life practice. And I'm going to give you a few concrete examples at the beginning to give you a sense of what this looks like. And then I'm going to refer to the suttas. And hopefully in the question and answer period, I'll have a chance to hear from you as to ways in which you've done this application of the practice in your daily lives. So at VIMC, Vermont Insight Meditation Center, we teach courses 3 nights a week, and one of the courses that we're currently teaching on Thursday night is on dependent co-arising. It's a complex teaching from the Buddha. Some of you have probably studied it. But we find ways to ask our students to learn about the teaching and then to apply it to their meditation practice and to their daily life practice. So here is one of the assignments that we gave the first week of the course. And in the first week of the course, we were focusing on the first link. The chain of dependent origination has 12 links, and the first link is the link called ignorance. So here's the first week's assignment. This week, undertake the investigation into the possibility of removing ignorance in the midst of your life. This week, bring awareness and mindfulness to beliefs, views, and opinions that influence your thoughts and actions. And as I'm saying these instructions, you might, you know, try and do this in your mind right here and right now. Begin by taking an inventory in your mind of all the views and opinions that you hold about one other person in your life, preferably a person with whom you are in contact on a regular basis. A lot of people in the class actually took people that they live with, their partners, their spouses, their children, as the person that they wanted to recognize the views and opinions that they held about that person. So this is the rest of the assignment. Throughout the week, pay attention to the ways in which your beliefs, views, and opinions play themselves out automatically. Pay attention to the physical level, to any tension or stress in your body. Notice how the tension and stress might relate to the views and opinions that you hold in relation to this person. How do you see this other person in light of those views and opinions? And if you change those views and opinions, how do you see this person? Ask yourself, at different points in time, is this view and opinion skillful or is it unskillful? Does it lead to letting go? Does it lead to aversion? Does it lead to compassion? How does it change your mind? How does it change the experience of the person you're investigating? So that was the assignment. Has anybody done something like this before? I'm just curious. Anybody undertaken something like this? Great. Okay. So it might be something new. One of the women in the class came back the next week, and she had noticed a view and an opinion that she had about her husband. Her perception was that her husband was a stubborn person. And she began to notice how this perception of him being stubborn actually narrowed the way in which she saw her husband. She actually noticed how when she saw him through this lens of stubborn person, that was all she saw. And how when she released this view or opinion of stubborn person, how it freed her up to see he's not always a stubborn person. There are plenty of moments when he's a kind person. There are plenty of moments when he's a confused person. There are plenty of moments when he's a fearful person. There are plenty of moments when he's a caring person. So she came back to the class saying, you know, I've really noticed how these views and opinions narrow the way in which I perceive other people. Maybe it even affects how the other person actually interacts with me, if that's the way I'm seeing them all the time. So this is a very concrete example of something that we can investigate at any point in our lives. Just quickly, in relation to the teaching of ignorance in the links of dependent origination, the Buddha was actually talking about ignorance as being the ways in which we ignore certain truths, the ways in which we ignore primarily the Four Noble Truths, the ways in which we ignore our own personal suffering or the suffering of those in our lives. The ways in which we ignore, and this is one of the direct teaching, how there's a veil of beliefs, opinions, and views through which we perceive others. And hence, how we suffer, or perhaps how we cause suffering. This kind of waking up, this kind of enlightenment, can happen right in the midst of our lives. Not on a cushion or alone or silent, but actually in interaction with those in our lives and perhaps with those we love. I want to give another concrete example. It was mentioned in the introduction that Jack and I teach a certificate program in mindfulness for educators, and we teach the face-to-face section of that program at Barry Center for Buddhist Studies, and the rest is taught in online seminars. We teach secular applications of mindfulness and compassion in educational contexts primarily. There's a student in the certificate program who has given us permission to share her reflections on daily life applications and how this leads for her and for the people that she works with. It leads them to greater wisdom and compassion in the midst of their work. The student's name is Dr. Rayanne LeBlanc. She teaches nursing students at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. And this is an example of instructions that she gives to her students on how to bring mindfulness and compassion into a seemingly highly unlikely place. In this case, it's in a hospital between a nurse and a patient. So here's what Rayanne posted on the course last week. She says, I often struggle with the procedures and practices that inflict discomfort on others, even in the process of protecting them from a disease. I try to teach students to give injections as an act of intentionality, mindfulness, and compassion. Most people do not like getting injections, and many nursing students do not like giving them. Though this is often a trivialized skill professionally, It is one that nursing students feel identifies one as a nurse, at least in the early phase of one's career. When I teach students, I ask them to pause 3 times with intentionality, mindfulness, and compassion to create well-being for the client and for themselves. First, I ask them to pause before they even introduce themselves to the patient. And at this point, they're supposed to explain what they're doing and why. So this is, you know, setting up some kind of a relationship with the patient. And she's asking the student, and she does this herself, or she wouldn't be asking the student to do it, to actually pause and connect with mindfulness and compassion. Next, the nursing student pauses before they inject. So imagine, wouldn't it be nice if the people who are giving us injections or taking blood, if they paused with wisdom and compassion before giving us the injection. Next, they're supposed to pause just before they inject. And at that point, they ask the client, the patient, to take a deep in and out breath, because if you take a deep in and out breath, you actually relax your muscles. Finally, I ask them to pause just before they remove the needle, because often students, out of fear, remove the needle too soon, along with half of the medicine. So there's 3 points within the actual practice of giving an injection. You know, as you're talking to the patient, just before you put in the needle, and just before you're about to remove the needle. I'll finish what Rayanne says, and then I have a couple of comments. She says, after that, I ask them to reflect back on the skill with which they gave the injection and how that skill was affected by their intention and their mindfulness. It seems to change the experience for everyone. Intentionality is a path to greater self-awareness and thus part of the process of becoming conscious, even in the most tedious aspects of our lives and in the lives of others. So I find it fascinating, and perhaps you've read some of the literature on neuroscience, how the slowing down, the connecting with mindfulness and compassion in the moment actually helps us be more skillful. You know, this is a dramatic example, I think, of how it could really affect something very important, like giving all of the medicine during the injection and not losing part of it. I often find people can't, you know, get the actual vein. Anyway, we won't go into all the details of giving injections, but just how mindfulness and compassion can affect something quite important. And this is exactly what the Buddha taught. I'm going to come back to Rayanne's example, but first I'm going to talk about 3 suttas. The first sutta that I want to reference is the Satipatthana Sutta, and perhaps many of you in the room have already studied the Satipatthana Sutta. It's the sutta that outlines the 4 foundations of mindfulness. And the foundation that is extremely important in the example I gave you of the student in our class and in the example from Rayanne's nursing students is the importance of mindfulness of mind. This is the 3rd foundation of mindfulness. And, you know, I went to the text and referred to the exact wording in the Pali Canon. And every time I read the Buddha's words, I'm so struck by how direct they are. In many ways, extremely simple or seemingly simple. He outlines the practice in this way. He says a bhikkhu, and because he's usually addressing monks, in the text it says a bhikkhu, but that means all of us, any person. A person understands mind affected by hate as mind affected by hate, and mind unaffected by hate as mind unaffected by hate. He gives the same instruction for greed or desire, and the same instruction for delusion. This is pretty simple. Know or understand a mind affected by hate. So if you take the full spectrum of what hatred, what the manifestations of hatred are in the mind, can begin with this very slight irritation, and then it can go to a stronger aversion or a real pushing away. It can be a form of fear. It can be a form of just not liking, get me out of here kind of thing. Or it can be real animosity, real anger. And the Buddha uses the word hatred. But he's really talking about the full spectrum. So if one can pause in the midst of one's life, in the midst of a conversation with your partner, with your friend, with a colleague, with a fellow student, if one can pause in the middle of that and know what's going on in my mind right now, is my mind at this moment in time influenced by irritation? Actually, Jack kind of gave these instructions during the meditation practice as well. Can we know that the mind is entangled and influenced by aversion, influenced by irritation, influenced by anger? But the Buddha doesn't leave us there. He doesn't just say, notice that. He also says, notice a mind unaffected by hate. And this is part of early Indian Buddhist philosophy, where there's a lot of the, you know, the non-hatred, the non-greed, the non-delusion. But he's really talking about love, the mind state of love, the mind state of caring. So know a mind that is affected by hate, and know a mind that is affected by love. Know a mind that is affected by compassion, by caring. If you're like me, you might be sitting there at whatever point you are in your practice. You might say, "Ah, I can't do that all the time. It's just too hard. That would just be an awful lot of work," right? Remember, I said wisdom and compassion at work. And it is work. It takes effort. But here's another sutta that I really love by the Buddha. And actually, on the internet, Sharon Salzberg's website, she calls it her favorite sutta. And the Buddha says, "Cultivate the wholesome. If it were not possible, I would not ask you to do so. And so I say, cultivate the wholesome. Abandon the unwholesome. If it were not possible, I would not ask you to do so. And therefore I ask you, abandon the unwholesome. If the cultivation of the wholesome would bring harm and suffering, I would not ask you to cultivate it. But as the cultivation of the wholesome brings benefit and happiness, therefore I say, cultivate the wholesome." This is possible. And I can return to those words. You know, I love the images of cultivating and abandoning. Another image that the Buddha uses often is feeding and starving, something we discussed in our class, our Monday night class, just a few weeks ago, how we can feed certain mind states and we can starve them. We can just not keep doing them. We can just stop in the midst of our lives. Another very, and this is the third teaching of the Buddha that I'll talk about tonight. There's a wonderful sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. It's called the Ambalatika Rahulavada Sutta, or Instructions to Rahula at Ambalatika. Rahula, some of you may know, was the Buddha's son, and he became a monk, as did actually all of the Buddha's family. And in this sutta, the Buddha is instructing Rahula very clearly and directly on how to reflect on his experience. This is where I'm getting to the part of the Buddha as a reflective practitioner. He exhorted him on how to reflect on his experience at the level of thoughts, at the level of speech that then comes from what the thoughts are, and at the level of actions that are the accumulative energy that come from the thoughts and the speech. And even if we haven't said something, we've often had a rehearsal of what we're going to say or what we're going to do inside of our minds. So here are the words of the Buddha in this Ambalatika Sutta. What do you think, Rahula? What is a mirror for? Rahula. For reflection, sir. The Buddha. In the same way, Rahula, bodily actions, verbal actions, and mental actions are to be done with repeated reflection. Whatever you want to do in ways at the level of a bodily action, you should reflect on it. This bodily action that I want to do, will it lead to self-affliction, to the affliction of others, or to the affliction of both? If on reflection you know that it would lead to self-affliction, the affliction of others, or to both, it would be unskillful. And this kind of action is not fit for you to do. But if on reflection you know that it would not cause affliction to you, to another person, or to both of you, it would be a skillful bodily action with pleasant consequences, pleasant results, and any bodily action of that sort is fit for you to do. So let's take this advice to Rahula and go back to the instructions that Dr. LeBlanc gave to her students. Remember, she asked them to pause 3 times. So to pause before undertaking an action and to notice the mind state. Notice, is there aversion? Notice, is there fear? If there is aversion or fear, how can I interact with the heart and mind? Can I take a deep breath in and out? Can it relax me? Can it allow me to be in that moment with greater skill? Can I notice before I leap forward? So many of us on automatic pilot these days. Can we pause and reflect before undertaking an action and notice whether it would cause affliction? Would it cause affliction to myself, to the other one involved, or to both of us? In the case of a nurse and a patient, it could very literally be an unskillful action affected by a mind state. And maybe a very understandable mind state. If one is a new student of nursing and you haven't given many injections, you might be pretty nervous. You might be fearful. And yet, can you take time to apply mindfulness, to apply compassion in the moment? In recognizing fear, can it allow contraction or aversion in the mind to relax? Can it allow contraction or aversion in the body to relax? And in this way, can he or she, the nursing student, then abandon the unwholesome and come back into balance and harmony in a way that allows a more skillful action? This is how the Buddha taught us to reflect. It's a reflective practice. in the midst of our lives that can be learned, that can be practiced by setting intentions and asking ourselves questions in the midst of our lives. The Buddha says, know a mind that is filled with hate as a mind that's filled with hate. But we can turn that into a question. We can, in the middle of our lives, say, okay, what's my mind state right now? Jack used the expression, am I entangled? Is the mind entangled? Or is the mind open? Is there compassion? Is there caring? Is there fear? Is there confusion? We can turn towards and recognize what is there in the moment. We can learn to practice what the Buddha taught us 2,600 years ago. What we have also found that is particularly helpful in the case of this seems like an awful lot of work. I don't know if I can do this. What really helps is to not do it all alone. It really helps to have a friend. In our case, we're particularly lucky because we're husband and wife. We live with one another. We can do this kind of reflection all the time, actually. But you too could choose someone you live with to do this kind of reflection in a very secular way, not necessarily in a you have to be Buddhist in order to do this practice with me. But you can also do it with people here at Vermont Insight. Cambridge Insight. This kind of reflective practice in community, in Sangha, is actually what the Buddha did in his day. There were monks, there were nuns, and there were lay people. He met with them on a regular basis. They had an opportunity to talk about what he was teaching, to ask questions, to talk about how to apply things. You too have this opportunity here at Cambridge Insight. So in ending the talk tonight, I'd like you to each take a moment and just come inside to take a moment to contact your heart and your mind. And I'm going to ask you to do a reflection for yourself. Take a moment to reflect on a context where you could apply the teaching that I've just been talking about. Which context would be the easiest? Indeed, it might be difficult to imagine doing this all the time. But could you choose a particular context? Would the context be at home in relationship to a person you live with? Would the context that would be easiest for you be a work-related context, a job-related context? Or would a context like something that you do very frequently all day long? Could you apply this teaching to writing and receiving emails, for example, or writing and receiving and reading memos? Choose something right now and imagine yourself in the midst of that particular context, taking moments to reflect on the actions that you take in that context. Take a moment to see yourself there, pausing and connecting with this inner life, connecting with the mind, the third foundation of mindfulness. Pause and see what's there. Not out of any strategy for recrimination, but out of a strategy for learning, for seeing clearly, out of a strategy or desire, a healthy desire to wake up, to be more wise, to be more compassionate in life. See yourself noticing when there's aversion, noticing when there's kindness. Noticing when the aversion is a self-affliction or when it's an affliction toward another person or the people in that context. And as the Buddha taught, also notice when there's a mind of kindness, of caring and compassion towards yourself, towards another person in your context. Towards the people in your life. See yourself undertaking this teaching that the Buddha taught so long ago, but that we can live today. Noticing before you undertake something, while you're in the midst of it, and then after you do it.